16, verse 9 to 11. Therefore, the psalmist says, therefore my heart is glad, my soul rejoices, my body dwells secure, for thou dost not... Now, King James says, thou dost not leave me in hell. Actually, it's a better translation to, as the RSV has it. Now, notice what it says. Thou dost not give me up to Sheol. Now, that's better than thou dost not leave me in Sheol. Thou dost not give me up to Sheol, or let thy godly ones see the pit. I'm not, as a Christian, I'm not even going to see the pit. Thou dost show me the path of life. Now, when I die, in thy presence there is fullness of joy, because that's what heaven is, being in the presence of God. In thy presence is fullness of joy, and at thy right hand, pleasures forevermore. Some modern theologians have said all this means is this, this all happens before a person dies. A man got real sick, and somehow the doctor helped him so that he didn't die. And so the psalmist says, I'm real thankful, Lord, because you didn't give me up to death. You didn't let me see the grave, but rather you brought me back to life, and now I'm full of happiness. Well, this is taking the guts out of the whole passage, because you remember in the New Testament, this passage is quoted also with regard to Jesus rising on the third day. And I see it this way, this is a messianic passage where God did not leave Jesus' soul in Sheol. Even here. He didn't leave it there, but he brought it back to life. And then because of that, now you won't give me up to Sheol at all. I won't have to go there because he went there for me. You see, please.
Now, you are understanding Sheol here in the house.
Yeah, that's right.
In that case, how would that be connected with the traditional Lutheran stance that Jesus has body and soul in hell?
Yeah. I think what is being referred to here, when did Christ go to hell in order to suffer there?
On the cross.
When he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? I think there he was in Sheol. He was forsaken of God. Now, later on, he went down to hell in order to show Satan he was conqueror. But those are two acts, you see. This is a very difficult set of passages, and that's the way I understand it, you see. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I can certainly see critical philosophy that this has nothing to do with fight after death, but simply that he was delivered at one time from
death.
Now he's living, and now there's nothing to reply to it after death at all.
That's right. If a person looks, Luther would say, if you look at this passage the way a cow looks at a gate, that is, just see the surface symptoms, you can easily get that out of there. That's right, because if you weren't conversant with other passages in Scripture and with the fact that Christ did descend into hell on the cross, I mean, he did suffer, put it this way, he suffered the pangs of hell on the cross. If we weren't acquainted with that, we probably would draw that same conclusion. And I can see where they can get an exegesis out of it like that, you see. But that's the reason I use that expression, if we look at it, just as these surface symptoms. But I see more than that due to the way in which the New Testament uses that very passage.
I was just going to say that, speaking of that, it's quoted in that context.
Yeah.
In the New Testament, it's
an indication. Yeah, that's right. Whenever it's quoted in the New Testament and applied to Jesus' resurrection, it must refer to at least the grave. You see. Yeah.
Isn't this word that is used here, or let thy godly one see the pit? Pit always is the code word for hell.
Right. That's right. The pit, you see, that's more, Sheol only had these three meanings. But pit never has these three meanings. It always means hell. That's right. But you see, how do the, one might say, how can the, in view of that passage where this is quoted, I mean this passage here, Psalm 16, is quoted as referring to Jesus, one might say, how can modern scholars possibly omit that passage? You know what they do, don't you? They say, don't ever use the New Testament and read it back into the Old.
Right.
Yeah, that's what they say. And so they say, you're totally out of order when you quote from the New Testament to throw light on the Old. Rather, you should quote from the Old to throw light on the New.
You don't bring the 1611.
Pardon?
You don't bring in the 1611.
That's right. That's right. That's the idea. You must reconstruct only the Sitzim Leben as it existed at the time of the psalmist. The psalmist didn't know a thing about that quotation in the New Testament. That is their argumentation. Yeah. Well, the thing is, I do know, I think that Bible was written for me too. And I think the New Testament is the very best commentary on the Old that there is. The very best. Because it shows me what Jesus, how he read the Old Testament. You see. All right, now to go on. But look at what beautiful things it says about the Christian. God will ransom the Christian, the believer, from Sheol, will ransom. That's the word that's used. Ransom them from Sheol and receive them into his presence. Now we go back to that Psalm 49, verse 14 and 15. Now I've got to give you a little bit of the background of that reading in Scripture. The psalmist at the beginning of this passage says, there was a time in my life when I almost despaired. He says, I looked about me and it seemed as though the righteous were always downtrodden and the wicked were the ones who were gaining the most in this life. It seemed as though they were always getting ahead and the believer of God didn't pay any attention to them. And he says, I almost despaired there. I almost gave up, but finally, God gave me this understanding, God gave me this revelation, that the unbeliever, he has his heaven here on earth already. We have our pain and sorrow, he has his joy. But this is going to be reversed when we die. Because when we die, now comes the passage, like sheep, the wicked are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, straight to the grave they descend, and their form shall waste away, and Sheol shall be their home. I think that refers to hell also. Otherwise, there is no resurrection. But now it goes on, but God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. You see, you've got a contrast here. The wicked go to Sheol and stay there. But for me, for the believer, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. I think this happened when Christ died on the cross. We were ransomed. And for he will receive me. Now that word receive in Hebrew is lakach. Lakach. And I put it in English here. L-A-K-A-C-H. Lakach. I don't know what you think of Von Rad. Von Rad hasn't, sometimes he just isn't so good. But Von Rad has made an interesting observation here. He speaks language that we can understand here because he says, you know, the funny thing is this word, he shall receive me, is the very same word that the Bible uses in connection with the story of Enoch, where Enoch was received into heaven. And the same word is used in connection with Elijah. Both of these men were received into heaven. And now it's said of the believer, he too will be received into heaven. And so instead of just reading here, the words, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. You could really add, says Von Rad, he will receive me into heaven. This is an interesting observation. Here's another one. Psalm 73, verse 24. Here the context is very much the same. The psalmist is disappointed because the wicked prosper, the ungodly seem to gain, and the believer suffers. And now he says, but I've learned, thou dost guide me, a believer, with thy counsel, and afterward thou wilt receive me into glory. This is Old Testament eschatology as far as the believer is concerned. I die, and you guide, or rather, you guide me with your counsel, and then I die, and afterward you receive me to glory. Lakah is used there too, by the way. Whom have I in heaven but thee? And there is none upon earth that I desire beside thee. Another point, the righteous will be delivered from trouble, Proverbs 11, verse 7 and 8. I become amused at this passage, because here's the way the passage reads. When the wicked dies, his hope perishes, and the expectation of the godless come to naught. The righteous is delivered from trouble, and the wicked gets into it instead. There's a little humor there, I think. But this draws that distinction again. Of course, this is eschatology. Anybody who says they didn't believe in an afterlife in the Old Testament just hasn't read the Bible. That's all. The righteous is delivered from trouble. The wicked gets into it instead. And all of this in connection with death. You see, when the wicked dies, his hope perishes. When the righteous dies, he's delivered from trouble. Finally, there will be, according to Old Testament eschatology, there will be a resurrection of the dead. Now, I didn't know whether I should put this in here or not. Not that I don't believe it, I surely do. But look at the title up above, the teaching of the Old Testament concerning the state of death. Now, this, when we talk about the resurrection, this is no longer the state of death. But rather, it's the resurrection, which terminates the state of death. But I finally succumbed, and I had to put it in anyway, because it has to go here. That passage is familiar. I know that my Redeemer lives, that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And here the RSV has something like, and though my flesh shall be stripped from my bones, though my flesh will be torn from my bones, yet in my flesh I will see God, whom I shall see for myself. Mine eyes shall behold him, and not another. To me, this means not only that there will be a resurrection, but there will be a resurrection of the body. You see?
Yeah, I know that no one will
That's right.
But it's pretty good conjecture that the actual narrative takes place during the patriotic period.
Yeah. I always thought so. During the patriotic, in other words, this goes way back. Now, modern scholarship will say, oh, this undoubtedly is very late. But you see, the burden of the proof rests with them then. Now, why do they say it's late? Because they say, look at this passage, at least that much is late, because they couldn't possibly have had this advanced state of eschatology at that time. And you say, why not? And they said, well, of course, the children of Israel was not in captivity, had not gone into captivity yet. And you say, what difference does that make? And they say, that's where they got their eschatology. You see, it's an the cat chasing its tail. I can recall, by the way, I don't know if I should put this on tape or not. No, I don't mind putting it on tape. But while I was defending my thesis, because I wrote on this for my doctoral dissertation, and I had to defend it, of course. And after the panel, and that panel, nothing can look more overwhelming than a panel of these PhDs and PhDs who have been PhDs and THDs for 20 years, and now you're a little budding PhD, and so they're all around there. You think they know 17 times as much as you do. Well, you feel quite overwhelmed, and but they do a lot in order to build up your courage. I know one man down there. I'll have to mention his name. It's Dr. Brecher, not the one in Valpo now, but his father. He saw me ahead of time, and he says, "You know, don't forget." He says, "Not another of these men have written on this subject. You're the only one." He says, "You probably know more about it than anybody else here." Of course, that made me feel good. I still doubted that I knew more than they did. After all, they had been teaching Old Testament for a long time. But I'm just giving this as an illustration of how they try to set you at ease. But anyway, he succeeded in setting me at ease. So after they had asked me all the questions that they wanted to, and they were very generous, very good, then I said, "By the way, do you mind, since I'm in the presence of men who have been working in this field much longer than I, do you mind if I ask a question that I haven't been able to gain an answer for with all the study that I've done?" And they said, "Yes, that's all right." I said, "Well, now, in modern theology, they claim that Israel got its eschatology from Persia." Mm-hmm. Now, couldn't it possibly be, or how could it be otherwise, than that they, wait a minute, let me reword that. How could they possibly have been without an eschatology when you keep in mind that they had spent 400 years in Egypt from about 1800 BC to 1400 BC? Egypt was the most eschatologically developed country. You see my point? You would thought, how could they have come out of Egypt without an eschatology and stayed without an eschatology until the captivity? And one of the men there said, "Well, you've got to keep in mind that while it's true Egypt had an eschatology, but the Israelites were slaves, and that eschatology was primarily among the nobility, and so it never reached down to them." And then I did the unforgivable. I said, "But wasn't Moses, their leader, trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians?" And nobody said a word. And we soon disbanded. You see, I don't see how it can possibly be scholarly to say the Israelites came out of Egypt with vacuum as eschatology. And when you travel down to Egypt now, I was just there earlier this year. The graves of the kings, and everywhere you look, you see the theology, the eschatology, at least of the Middle Bronze era, that's around 1800. This had an overwhelming eschatology. Now, how in heaven's name could the Israelites have come out of that without having some knowledge of a life after death? I can't imagine how. You see, you get my point? Mm-hmm. I haven't the least confidence in those who say that that Israel got their eschatology in Persia. Because to me this means that Israelites are the most stupid people that there are. And whenever you keep in mind that they were God's chosen people, that God gave his revelation to these people, how can we possibly say that?
You think just because they're hauling that block of rock up the ramp, and somebody says, "What am I doing this for besides the fact that guy's got a whip?"
That's right. And a nation that is under, a people who is under persecution will think of the life after death faster than one who is wallowing in wealth.
a man like Bookman, you know, and Jesus and the Word, you know, they always make this thing between Greek and Hebrew thought, and I have so much fun just showing, you know, when they think it's a Greek thought, and I just go back and try to find it in the Hebrew, you know, or vice versa.
Yeah.
There's really no criterion for judging one or whatever
that's
the other.
This idea, you see, whenever you see a theology in the heathen world and a theology in Israel that are similar, it's arbitrary to say the Israelites got it from the Ugarites or the Arabs. This is totally subjective. I like to think of it the other way. Israel had the prophets. The others had prophets, but false prophets, says Isaiah. Now, who shall we believe, the prophets of Israel or the prophets of the Phoenicians, prophets of Baal, and so forth? Who shall we believe? Of course, I start with different presuppositions than those men do. Somebody else had a hand up here. Please.
Yeah, you mentioned presuppositions. In the end, aren't a lot of these theories based on basically Hegelian philosophy?
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
And it's sort of an 18th century philosophy dragged right into the Bible and something nothing of them.
That's right. Unfortunately, theologians have been the biggest imitators of philosophy right from the beginning. And Hegel had a tremendous influence there. Yes, I believe that's right. That's what lies, not Hegel, but other philosophers lie behind the unity of man. But religion, it seems, for some reason has thought that it had to blend its belief with the philosophy of the day. Well, two more passages. Isaiah 26, verse 19 is again a passage dealing with the resurrection. And notice how beautifully this teaches a resurrection. The dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. O dwellers in the dust, awake and sing, for thy dew is a dew of light, and on the land of shades thou wilt let it fall. Oh, if that doesn't picture the coming of Christ and Christ's descent into hell, even, you see. Yes. But one thing that is interesting to me is this. The dead shall rise, their bodies shall. The dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. Now, the interesting thing is there is no word in the Old Testament for body. What word do you suppose they used here? No, flesh. This would have been just as strong as this word, but they didn't use basar, interestingly enough. They used the Hebrew word for the English carcass. Now that's as strong as basar. Carcass. Brethren, what's a carcass? A carcass is the flesh and blood usually we use it of animals, but I guess you can use it, we'd say corpse, but it means the same thing. To me, this means the resurrection of the basar. I think the only reason that the Old Testament writer didn't use basar is what? Basar is oftentimes used of this as it exists in sin after the fall, you see. In other words, basar and ruach are in opposition to one another, flesh and spirit. Pneuma or pneuma and soma, not soma, sarx. That's right. So the word basar, like sarx, is a little bit tainted. And so he used the word carcass to indicate the flesh and blood. And I think this teaches the resurrection of the flesh. The resurrection of, in this body I shall see God. It'll be a glorified body someday. But so help me, you're going to recognize me and I'll recognize you because I saw you here. You see? And then Daniel 12, verse 2.
Question.
Yeah.
I know this is speaking here on believers.
Yeah.
It begins with thy dead shall live.
Yeah.
Is there any distinction made there?
it refers, of course, I think it refers to the unbeliever too. They will rise in their bodies. Although it refers, first of all, to the Christian. But it isn't intended, I don't think you...
I wouldn't see it as ruling out the unbeliever.
No. But the emphasis is on the Christian. Yeah. Because, O dwellers in the dust, awake and sing for joy, can't refer to the unbeliever. But I believe that...
this is speaking of unbelievers.
Yeah. That's right. Here it refers primarily to the... Put it this way. Here I believe it refers to the believers, but... Part of this is true of the unbeliever, too, that their bodies shall rise. But you wouldn't get it from this passage. You will get it from the next, though, Daniel 12, verse 2. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Brethren, that's New Testament. You see, that's New Testament. Well, let's make a break here. We went on a little bit longer than... All right, then let's start with the question that you want to ask, and this is with regard to Job 19:25-27. There's a rather interesting translation in this passage. Would you read?
Okay, this is in my RSV. It says, and after my skin has been destroyed, then without my flesh, I shall be God.
Yeah.
And the footnote says, then from my flesh, I shall be God.
Yeah. That's right. Now, do any of the rest of you have a... Now, that, if you look at the beginning, you'll find that that revised version was published prior to 1952. Now, does someone have a more recent? Would you read it?
I just reverse it then.
Yeah.
In the text, it says, from my flesh, and in the footnote, it says, or...
Yeah, that's right. You know, this is an interesting story. Why did the RSV change the translation from without my flesh shall I see God to from my flesh shall I see God? Isn't that the word they use?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, the Hebrew word is min. Min. Now, min can mean either away from or from within. I can stand at this window and say, from this window I see the tree. Or I can say, I can use min to refer to if I'm outside the window and it says, outside of this window I see a tree. When I'm standing outside of the window. It can mean both of those. So it leaves it a little bit uncertain. Now, that change, I was on the Bible Versions Committee at the time that the RSV came out. And our synod, our church body, had a reputation of having some pretty good Hebrew scholars in its midst. And so the translators of the RSV listened very carefully when our Bible Versions Committee would offer suggestions. And this was one of the first suggestions that we made, that look at that passage should not read outside of my flesh, or when I no longer have flesh shall I see God. And we argued that it should be just like the King James had, yet within my flesh shall I see God. And we didn't do a very good job convincing them at the beginning, and finally one of our number said, you know, if you let it read as it read originally, outside of my flesh shall I see God, that proves immortality of the soul. And they didn't want to prove the immortality of the soul. So they took the suggestion, from my flesh shall I see God. And we said, well, that's fine. That proves the resurrection of the body. So, brethren, we haven't a thing to lose. We haven't a thing to lose. That passage either proves the immortality of the soul or the resurrection of the body. And I'll settle for both. Yeah. Interesting. But to get back to what I said at the beginning, in our synod, and this is exclusive of me, I'm not... but in our synod, we have some excellent Hebrew scholars. And these translators recognized it. We always, on a committee like RSV, we always have representatives from our synod. We've got some of the finest Hebrew scholars in the country. And they listen to us whenever we tell them, look at this translation, doesn't sound so good to us. They haven't followed us in all ways, but the RSV translation is much better today than it was 20 years ago. Much better. And we hope that it'll still improve still more. For instance, those seed passages back in Genesis need changing. But and that Isaiah 7 verse 14, behold, a young woman shall conceive and bear a son, needs changing. But you see, you win some, you lose some. And that's the way it is with us there. I'm glad you brought it up, because that's a change that was made already in 1952.